You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning and welcome. The last week of the government fiscal year. It's an interesting time. Conveniently, we're primed to talk about Article 1. As you think about funding, the Congress is the branch that is responsible for the dollars, among many other powers. Brookings Executive Education has run programs on how the government works for a long time. Multiple day seminars such as Inside Congress, where we give people an understanding of how this place works and its institutions operate. And this book, which we'll talk about, Inside Congress, is an opportunity for every American and others to really understand how the Congress operates on the floor. Not in a technical how a bill becomes a law format, but the totality. And it's something I would encourage everybody to read, share with your friends, and utilize in those holiday conversations you have with your family so you can actually know when somebody says something that's wrong, how to correct them appropriately. The Congress is the preeminent power, no matter what you may read or see in the news. But why? How does it operate? These fine folks will have a nice conversation and explore the Congress with you. It's going to be moderated by Brookings Senior Fellow from Governance Studies, John Hudak. So enjoy, and on your way out, please purchase a copy.
Well, thank you, Ann, for the introduction. Thank you all for coming. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is John Hudak. I'm a Senior Fellow in Governance Studies and the Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management. I'm pleased to be joined on the dais today by three distinguished authors, three distinguished experts of the Congress who wrote a book that was obviously available outside what we'll be talking about today, Inside Congress, A Guide for Navigating the Politics of the House and Senate Floors. If you made the terrible life choice of not purchasing it on your way in, I strongly suggest that you purchase it on your way out. It's a quick read. It's very informative. As someone who is a classically trained political scientist, I read about House and Senate procedure in graduate school in much more brutalist ways than this book offered, and I'm just sorry that this was not available years ago when I was taking a legislative process class. Before I talk a little bit about the book and then jump into some questions, I'm going to introduce our panelists. All the way to my furthest right is Trevor Corning. Trevor is a Brookings alum, and he is currently a project manager at Chief, where he helps organizations reach their true potential. To his left is Rima Dodine. Rima serves as floor director to the Democratic Whip, Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, where she runs the Whip operation for the Senate Democratic Leadership Team. Certainly just a really easy task, especially these days. And immediately to my right is Kyle Nevins. Kyle is a seasoned former top aide to House leadership with extensive experience in the process and politics of the U.S. Congress, which obviously comes through in this book. This book very nicely walks through first the House of Representatives and then the Senate, talking about procedure, which can be a dry topic. That's probably not news to any of you, but in the time we're living, we are seeing every day how complicated legislative procedure and legislative process is. Right now in the Senate, we have a healthcare bill that is being seemingly changed every day. But what we're seeing from this process is how difficult it is to understand what is going on day to day. It's not something unique to healthcare. It's something that is true of a lot of legislation moving through the U.S. Congress, and that is, looking from the outside, it is very difficult to understand, frankly, how a bill becomes a law. This book helps anyone, whether you are seasoned in understanding legislative procedure, whether you are new to the topic, whether you are a high school student, a college student, or you're 100 years old, and everyone in between. This is something where you read some. This book is something that will help you read the news more acutely, understand C-SPAN a whole hell of a lot better, I'll tell you. I learned a lot from this book. I've been studying this topic and ones related to it for a while, and every page was something a little bit new, a little bit more clarity, a whole lot of information, and I think what its greatest strength is that it is apolitical. We have authors who have supported staff, who have supported elected officials of both political parties, and you'd never know it reading this book. And that is a real strength. It's something we don't see in our politics right now. It's something we don't see even in a lot of academic writing right now. But they were able to strip away their party labels, their bosses' party labels, and just talk about procedure in a way that is easy to understand and digest. And so, enough about me. Let me get to the experts about what this book is about. So the way I'm going to run the ship today, I'm going to have Trevor start off by talking a little bit about what the goals of this book were and how those goals were achieved. And then I'm going to have our other two panelists, Rima and Kyle, talk each about their respective chambers that they have worked in and what they learned while writing this book and what they hope you learn while reading this book. Trevor?
Thanks, John. And thanks so much for being here today and all of you for being here. It's a huge privilege to be here with Rima and Kyle and John and all of you to talk about our book. I couldn't have asked John to actually set me up better. You know, he pointed out what he learned from the book and how he feels it's simply procedure stripped away politics here. And that's exactly what I'm going to go over is what we felt we wanted to get out of this book and what we wanted to present to all of our readers in here. So he's asked that I start with a couple objectives, and I pulled out the highlights to introduce the other two authors here. So first and foremost, as we note within the first few pages, it was a huge goal and sort of the focus of this book that we wrote something that is succinct and in plain language, so that anybody that is a high school student, a college student, maybe a constituent who's being brought in for a fly-in to meet with their member can learn something from this book, but it's also informative enough for a senior-level private sector manager who's being asked to contribute to government affairs for the first time. And this was just of the utmost importance for us because there are so many incredible books on the nuance of Congress, and we didn't feel that any of them really offered a clear, accessible, and short description that anybody could really pick up and read very quickly. As John mentioned, this is a 100-page book, takes a couple hours to read, and we're very, very happy about that. And so the decisions we made about what to include here and how to describe them were with that in mind. Some things are so nuanced that we could have written entire books about them, and as I said, others have done just that. Second to that point is that we really wanted to dissuade people of the notion that what they were taught in school as a high schooler or maybe middle schooler or what they watch on TV is as simple as it looks. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news here, but Mr. Bill does not dance his way from hearts and minds down the Capitol steps and into the president's desk. It's just not that simple. It's a great start to describing that process, but we wanted to offer more detail to bring to light the complexity within all of that. Third, it was critical that this was a nonpartisan and non-judgmental effort. While we individually all have opinions and backgrounds, we really wanted to make sure that those didn't come through and result in any sort of uncertainty from our readers about the facts we were providing. You've probably noticed that procedures like these are used as talking points in election campaigns, but there's never really context or history offered for them in those campaigns. So we want to help shape that context by explaining the Rules Committee or multiple referrals, hotlining, cloture votes, committee of the whole, reconciliation, words that you sort of hear as buzz terms on the news, but aren't given any context of what they really mean. We also really wanted to make clear the unique challenges and value of each chamber. It's important to not only tell the story of each independently, but also as a narrative to highlight the structure of our two-chamber system. They're very different in their proceedings, and as such, their complementary and contrasting nature is really fundamental to the end goal of having an informed reader here. So with these foundations in mind, we really hope to advance basically a more common understanding of Congress and empower anybody who's interested to engage at any level that they desire, whether you're a watcher, an advocate, a staffer, or maybe you're an aspiring politician. And as we state within the first few pages of the book, and Ian so gracefully pointed out, you know, Congress is Article 1, and in my opinion, understanding it should be step one for every citizen. Our laws and everyday lives are impacted by this institution, and so even on the most basic level, I hope that we've encouraged, you know, just normal people to have an interest in Congress.
Great, Trevor. Thanks for that. Before I turn it over to Rima and Kyle, I just want to remind everyone that everyone here is here in their own capacity, not representing the institutions from which they hail, including me. And so some sensitivity about that, just so we're all on the same page. These are the views of each individual on this stage and not necessarily the places that they work. So I'll jump next to Rima, if you want to talk a little bit about what you wanted your readers to better understand about the Senate and what the process of writing this book was like.
Sure, thank you. First, I just want to say good morning, and thank you to Ian for finding us, and John for being here, and our co-writers. And I just want to say, as someone who's always late to events, to the latecomers, there are chairs here. if you would like to come and sit, make yourselves comfortable, please. I'll just say at the outset that I'm a congressional romantic, and I first came to D.C. at 16 and was immediately taken in by how open Congress was, that you walk around and you could see, at the time, I think it was like Phil Graham's office, and this was in the late 90s, and I saw Senator Feinstein, and I got to see Congressman Christopher Cox, my Orange County congressman at the time, and I was taken in by how open it is and how I think so many people don't feel that Congress is that open for them. That it's sort of this mysterious black box where fancy things happen and then you read about it in the news, and that's it, or that there's a certain alignment of folks who do feel it's open for them and everyone else it's sort of there. But it is, of all the actual structures and all the places, it is truly meant for everyone. And I think going into this is, to echo Trevor, part of it was just trying to make it feel more accessible. We looked around, and even when I'm talking to people that are looking to come to the Hill or getting started, or people that are new to the Hill, you know, being in the press corps, or others who are just new to following politics. You know, maybe they have an issue they care about. Their cat got sick from cat food and now they're mad and, they want regulation. Across the board, a lot of the questions I was getting was very similar. And people always asked, well, how do you learn all this? And I think other than spending a lot of years doing it, there were a lot of beautiful sources that write about the House and Senate in these, you know, philosophical ways, or in like the deep game theory evaluation, or there are amazing resources that cover individual sections, you know, like going to conference, or what is a cloture motion? And we had a hard time finding something that was just kind of just the basic flow of what we do 90% of the time in one space. And I think all of us were really excited about the opportunity to put something like that out there, just to make it come alive for folks and for anyone who wants to engage on any level, to be able to turn on C-SPAN at any time of the week and say, I kind of have some, I see why this happened, or maybe this is why this bill failed, and to empower the individual in that way. I think one of the most interesting things about writing this was getting a sense for the, I will call it like the genius of the founders, and it sounds really cheesy, but it's true, and that the two chambers flow very differently, and it even came out in the editorial process, where I think that for the House majoritarian body, Rules Committee, you're able to set, you know, there's a structure, and there's points of light in the way that the debate comes to the floor and then flows on and off the floor if you can hold your coalitions together. And then when it came to writing about the Senate, it was a tough process. I mean, to keep it compact and to choose kind of on the 80-20 rule, what are we going to pull in for our 80% of the big terms that we use all the time? The Senate has a very different flow, and even in choosing how are we going to order it, section by section was difficult. You almost have to read the whole thing, get a sense of the terminology, and come back and read it again, and you'll be astonished at how different you experience the second reading of the Senate section, just having seen all the pieces come together. It is more of a dance, and it's meant to be that amongst the 100 members. And so even in the writing of it, it was almost a crucible for how the two chambers are structured so differently and then are designed to be the sort of bicameral legislative body. So it was fascinating.
Great. Kyle?
Yeah, well, first of all, are there any authors in the audience? Raise your hand. Yeah, at least a few. You have my admiration because this book is about 100 pages. The process to write this is as old as my oldest son, so 3 years old from start to this point. So things like this are very tough to do, especially when you have other jobs in your life. And I was happy to do it with both Rima and Ian and Trevor. I would say on the House side, what I wanted, much like Rima, I've always been an admirer of Congress. I've always had a fascination with Congress. So when I was in college, I set out to pursue that. I took one political science class. I hated it. I then took one public policy class, and I hated it. The material was just not approachable for me. It was very academic. It was very hard to understand. It wasn't tangible. I became a history major. I found that much more engaging than trying to understand something like politics from a textbook. So often when I talk to younger folks who are coming to D.C., when they're asking, how do you get that experience, congressional experience, government experience, you have to be there to learn it, in my opinion, and at least in my case. So that was very important for me. Going to the Hill, I spent 10 years on the Hill working in Republican leadership on the House side, 6 years for Roy Blunt and then 4 years for Eric Cantor. It was that experience that was more like my graduate degree in civics. You understand so much more by experiencing, especially when it comes to the Congress. You can read Jefferson's manual, and if you don't have the context for it, you're not going to get very far through it, or it's not going to understand very much. So that was the point of this, is to bring that to life for folks who may not have that Hill experience, where they can get this same sort of layman's read on what the Hill is like. The House, Rima touched on this, there's conflict between the two bodies, and we really wanted to drill down on that, and hopefully it was apparent in reading the book. The House side, my wife, who's actually here in the front row, and I'm glad to have her here, she knows how OCD I am. The House is a very OCD organization, so it fit me very well. We have structure and order on the House side, and a lot of that is driven by the fact that it's a majoritarian body. Less so recently, since about 2010 to today, it's become a little bit more freewheeling, but our calendar system drives a lot of the flow. The daily flow, the weekly flow, and the legislation itself is driven by the calendar. And on the House side, we are very structured in order in that regard. Part of that is the majoritarian side. Part of that is having 435 members, and you need to bring some order to them. They almost seek it. They love the order. They want to know when first votes are, when last votes are, when they're leaving for the week. And the sooner you can give that to them, the better. So you always see, in fact, that the House puts out a calendar for the coming year, usually by the end of October or so of the following year. So next year's calendar should come out by the end of October. The Senate is a little bit more, I won't opine, I'm not the Senate expert here, I won't opine on that and why they do it the way they do it, but the House loves structure. And so that, I hope, came through in the House section. But I'm glad to be here. Look forward to the conversation. Thank you, John.
Great. So I'm going to spend about 30 minutes or so asking our authors a few questions. Then we'll turn it over for about a half hour of Q&A from the audience. But Kyle, the way I'm going to structure this is go back and forth a little bit, a few questions for everyone, a few questions specifically on the House, some particularly on the Senate. But the last point you were making, Kyle, I think is a good one about the calendar and the schedule. And that's where I'd like to start. I think for a lot of people not working within Congress, it sometimes seems like there's absolutely no rhyme or reason about what's going on, what a day is like, what a week is like. This book very nicely talks about what a week in the House and a week in the Senate looks like and what it's structured like, and it's actually highly structured. Yep. There's some deviation. Can you guys talk a little bit about the week in the life of?
Sure, sure. And the main point there, again, is for someone flipping on C-SPAN in May versus someone flipping on C-SPAN or being in the House gallery or the Senate gallery in November, to have a decent sense before they turn on that channel or before they walk into the gallery, what it is that Congress is going to be doing that day of the week or that time of the year. And it's pretty predictable. Even as crazy as this last year has been with everything else going on, it's still fairly predictable what they're going to do and when they're going to do it. So on the House side, and this is a change when I was still there that we implemented at the end of 2010, Republicans won back the majority in the House. It was a large new incoming class. Democrats had controlled the House for the last 4 years, two before Obama and then the first 2 years of the Obama administration. We put in place a number of changes. One of the changes that we put in place was the House calendar, which really hadn't changed since about the 70s in terms of the structure of it. And what we wanted to do was maximize the time that members were here, but still give them good flexibility at home. One of the things that has happened over the years is members now basically live in their district. There are a few members who do live here in D.C., but by and large, members live back home. And part of that is just air travel. It's super easy to do. So we weren't going to change that. And yes, maybe that's led to some of the breakdown in collegiality. Members don't know each other as well. But you're not going to change that. They're going to go home if they have 24 hours between votes. It's just the way it is. So we tried to accommodate that. And what you'll see on the House side is a schedule that is usually Monday through Thursday, followed by Tuesday through Friday or something like that. And the reason is you're trying to give them a little bit longer of a weekend there to make that travel more easy. On the front half of a week, the House is almost always doing non-controversial business, what's called suspension, suspending the rules to pass non-controversial bills. It's an expedited procedure to consider something like a post office renaming or something very minor that has the support of both the majority and the minority, cleared a committee very easily, can pass with a two-thirds vote on the House floor. That's what they spend usually a Monday and Tuesday doing. The other thing that we did and we changed at the end of 2010 going into 2011 is protecting the morning for committees. We wanted the committee process to be rebuilt. It's kind of deteriorated a little bit since, but we wanted to protect time for them in the morning so that they weren't interrupted by votes. The House votes much more often than the Senate does, and we didn't want to interrupt committee time and create a protected pocket for them. So usually in the mornings on the House side, that you'll see some speeches on the floor, but that's just pro forma type speeches. The real legislative activity is taking place from noon until about 7 p.m. The latter half of the week is when they consider measures under what are called structured rules or special rules. Those are the more consequential pieces of legislation. And like I said, those occur in the afternoon and usually have the most important bill of the week, whatever the messaging item is or whatever, that's going to be on that last day before they leave town.
Great. Rima?
Thank you. So on schedule, we follow somewhat of a similar pattern. I think this plays out a little bit in the book that the calendar has to drive us because it also drives pressure points on the floor. You may have seen that, on this In the Senate, we basically consider three types of things. One are the deadline-driven items, so like the big stuff that we have to do. And then the other ones are boutique items, things that are specific to different topics, like defense authorization. And then the third are, I call them message bills, bills that are born to fail, but in their failing are part of a dialogue between the parties. And, you know, the sort of Senate leaders have, I want to say, some flexibility or different calculation in the way that they structure their floor time for a couple reasons. One is, you know, beyond the deadline-driven items, we move a little more slowly, right? We're supposed to be a chamber of infinite debate. And so when things arrive, it is possible it could take a whole week for a bill to not make it, let alone for a bill to make it, which could take even longer. And so if you're a leader and you're looking at your calendar, you're trying to figure out how you're going to cut up your weeks, you know, our week flow is similar. We bring our guys back Monday night. We try and ease them in with a pretty non-controversial vote because they probably haven't had a chance to talk to their staff until they land and get settled and get briefed up for the week. We try to recognize committee meetings. For us, they occur usually at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. In the way that we structure our vote times throughout the week. But for us, it's very fluid. We're sort of like hunter-gatherers in the Senate. You know, every morning we're like, well, what will the day bring? You know, what's possible? And, you know, part of what we're doing is, you know, amongst each side, the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, we all have to talk to our members and see, you know, what is your pain gain threshold for what we'd be trading on the floor? What is, you know, what are you trying to achieve that week? Is the coalition for it ripe and ready and healthy? Is this something that, you know, has enough to go or not? Or if you pair it with something, will it become sweet enough to move? And, you know, a hallmark of the Senate, especially in modern times, and this is where, you know, I'll echo Kyle that in the, I think for us, post-2010, but even starting in the early aughts, a shift to the increased use of the cloture rule. This is a force mechanism to end debate if you have basically 60 votes. That has de facto made it that if you want to move large-scale legislation in the Senate, you have to calculate for 60. Counting to majority usually won't cut it for you, and the regular legislative process. And so that guides, what that means is you are always in conversation. You are always figuring out amongst the 100, you know, what do people want and what is that trade-off. And so when you get to the day, you say, okay, well, let's vote. Let's have some votes. And the question is, are we going to vote on amendments? What will they be? Will they be germane to the bill? Will there not be? It is very open. And so at all, there's no way to read the rules without looking at the context of what else is happening. And I think that's one of the key things we're trying to emphasize here. So for our guys, the pressure points, we ease them in Monday, we call it a bed check vote. Tuesdays are the caucus lunches where they get to talk amongst themselves and figure out what do they want the week to look like. So, you know, if you have only 10 minutes you want to give a week, kind of watch Twitter or the news Tuesday afternoon after 2:15 when both leaderships come out of their caucus luncheons and kind of talk about how they want the week to flow. And that's where they're usually putting out kind of their tacit asks, you know, in the dance between all of us, you know, there's the said and the unsaid, and that's where you're going to get a lot of that meat on Tuesday afternoon. And then you get a feel for how the week's going to go. Will Wednesday be really hefty, and are we going to do a lot? Are we going to finish a bill Thursday before we can get them on their planes home, or are we going to have some delays and some drama, maybe a failure and then a resurrection? It is very unstructured where the House is structured, and it often depends on these other these kind of factors all coming together. We do try and get them out on Thursdays for the same reason. Members are really busy. We ask a lot of our elected officials these days in terms of their the demands here, meeting with constituents and committees and caucus and everything else and floor, and then beyond when they're back in their home states. And I'll just say more broadly, I think one thing that I hope came out in both sections is we were trying to give an appreciation for the idea that still waters run deep. I think sometimes there's like a little sense that, you know, if the Senate floor is in quorum call or if you're not seeing a lot of votes, there's not a ton of activity. There's a daily hefty amount of activity happening at all levels, I think, of both chambers that often goes unseen or takes a while to come to fruition. But between committee reports and oversight and letters and the constituent casework happening in the district offices, and district offices are super important and no one ever talks about them, but they are, for most constituents, they are probably the main office they'll ever encounter for their senators or congressmen, which I think is really extraordinary. And those inputs flow back into DC too, or that we track all our phone calls. We track if you write to your member, they'll read it, and it's all accounted for. And all of this flows. It's amazing still, you know, members will still wonder as they're figuring out how to vote, what do my constituents think? And so there is all those pressure points kind of come into the Senate floor. So that's our week structure, Monday through Thursday, with that Tuesday pressure point and then that Thursday endpoint. And then, you know, the traffic you see on the actual floor being debated is probably 5% of what's actually happening in the Senate, because we do the rest of it in a sort of behind-the-scenes dance called the hotline system, which is the way that we process things by unanimous consent. So if you have had a bill passed or your idea has written, it probably has come through the consent system or has written as part of a larger package that then came to the floor to help build a coalition. And so this is another way that we, I think, differ, is that I think on the House, you'll see in the suspensions, you'll see like 20 things listed and they're passing. And for us, all of a sudden, you'll see at the end of the night, very quietly, 10 bills have passed. And that has all happened in a behind-the-scenes negotiation called the hotline system, where it's, you know, committees have cleared it. Every office has taken a look at it. Everyone signed off on it and moved it along to help build consensus.
They're right there. Three things that are vastly different between two bodies that sit, are located right next to each other, but function so differently. The fact that they're always having this conversation amongst themselves on the Senate side, the 100, to see what the traffic can bear. House does not do that. The House is trying to have a conversation on what 218 is going to look like, and that's an internal conversation amongst the majority party.
And it's amazing just how much the numbers make a difference. Just, the idea of 100, they all, you know, even with the travel, like you have a sense for each other, right? It's like a rural high school size. Mm-hmm. So everyone knows everyone's business in a way. And you have 6 years, and so your word matters, reputation matters. I mean, and that's the way it was designed, is that, you know, in 6 years, there's time for me, you know, to say, to Kyle, like, if, you know, help me today, and like 3 years from now, you're going to need something, and he knows I'll probably be around to be able to enforce that. And it makes, that changes the metal of conversation, and that impacts the flow of our calendar.
And I think that's actually an important point also, to zoom the lens sort of out a little bit, because we talked about the timing of not only elections, but also it's important to take context into what the whole calendar year looks like. Was there an election that year? You have to consider when the president has his budget. You have to consider when the government fiscal year starts and ends. And so all of those pressures also create a structured system around the weeks and the day-to-day.
And the deadlines are definitely the starting point in the great dance.
Yeah.
So Rima, I'm going to pick up on a point you made during that answer, and you talked about the consent system in the Senate. And this is something you write about very well in the book and explain in rigorous detail. But it's an interesting part of Senate rules and Senate procedure, because the consent system really demands cooperation and for people to get along and agree with each other. I think if you turn on cable news and you look at the sample of U.S. senators who are speaking on any given cable show, you would never know that that Senate procedure was designed to enhance cooperation. So
don't tell anyone.
Can you talk a little bit about the consent system and how, even if it doesn't seem like it from the outside, there actually is a lot of cooperation going on in the Senate from day to day, issue to issue?
Sure. Yeah, many levels. I think for starters, it's a very big country. And so it started off smaller, but the premise being that you're going to pass something that's going to apply to California and Alabama and New York and Wisconsin, everywhere else. It should take some amount of consensus, have some discourse attached to it. And, you know, in the Senate, because of the endless debate structure, it was just not going to be feasible to move everything by large-scale debate on the floor, right? It's not. It just wasn't, you know, like a resolution honoring, that there are 7 days in the week. We can't debate it for a week. We can't. You know, we have to fund the government and have the other great debates. And so almost as a necessity, this secondary system came into being with just the uptick of action. But it still operates on the same political principle, which is that if you want to get something done in the Senate, you need to think long game. And so, you know, the way you start, you assume that's probably not the way you're going to end. So you introduce what you want, introduce your dream language. Or if you can, you know, if it's going to be bipartisan, find your counterpart and introduce it that way. Build your coalition. And most of these go through the regular process. They go to a committee. The committee marks it up. It gets reported to the Senate calendar. And then from there you say, okay, well, can we just ask, and it's literally through an email, can we ask all 100 offices if they're okay to pass this bill or this resolution or whatever it may be? If it's something expedited, if it's something urgent, we try and maybe skip the committee, but the committee staff are looking at it. You know, so you're, all these parts are still intact in a way. And then everyone gets to look at it. And if someone doesn't like it, any one person can stop it and say, no, I don't want it to go through this fast process. You need to find another way to move it. And then it being the Senate, you have a chance to talk, right? You have then a chance to engage in conversation. So a lot of hotlines run and take 4 or 5 months to clear. Some will never clear. And that's the prerogative of each senator to block things. And the ones that do, often you'll see that language has been changed. There have been negotiations. There have been additions. And it's come to this consensus point where all 100 say it's fine. You know, for tweaks and boutique items and, I mean, things that are well-studied, things that are well-measured, you know, there's usually a way to try and move it through. And, you know, I think there are going to be times where that process is halted. So I don't want to say that this is like always. There are times of, you know, we have rising contention and times that are kind of, things are more, are flowing more. But it is sort of, I'll call it like a mini version of what you see happen on the Senate floor, right? If you're going to see that played on the Senate floor, it'd be the 100 senators themselves debating and deciding and coming to a consensus on something that can move. This is just sort of like the behind-the-scenes staff and email, less sexy version of that process. And it happens all the time on a myriad of topics. And it's crucial to the functioning of the Senate.
Great. So, Kyle, let me ask a little bit about one of the powerhouses in the House, and that is the committee system. The committee system in the House is complex, and legislation moves through it or more often dies within it in a variety of ways and for a variety of reasons. But one of the interesting items in the House is multiple referrals. That is, a bill comes in, it's complex, it could be true of healthcare, it's been true of Homeland Security, it's true for a variety of topics where you have a lot of committee chairmen who want a grab at that. Can you talk a little bit about the multiple referral process in committees and how that can help or hurt the system, help or hurt the process for legislation, and how leadership has ways around it?
Sure. Well, first of all, it's all provided for in the House rules. So the rules package that passes at the beginning of each Congress lays out the jurisdictions of each of the House's standing committees. And so generally it's the job of the House parliamentarian to interpret those jurisdictions as legislation is introduced and then to go about referring it to various committees. Oftentimes, as you might imagine, someone's not fitting one idea into the exact jurisdiction of one committee. It's bleeding over into lots of different areas. Healthcare, as John mentioned, is a perfect example. That involves the Energy and Commerce Committee. It involves the Ways and Means Committee. It involves the Education and Workforce Committee. It's a lot of moving parts. So for something that big, it's super complicated, and it takes a long time to sort out. There can be sequential referrals where something's going to one primary committee and then going to secondary, tertiary committees. And there could be referrals where it's going all in tandem to committees across the board. Part of that, and this is where leadership comes in, can be managed by the leadership. So the speaker and the speaker's office, speaker's staff, is working hand in hand every day, not just on this issue, but lots of other issues, with the House parliamentarian. And they're interpreting with the House parliamentarian, sometimes giving direction to the House parliamentarian on how these referrals should be made. What committee should have it first, what committee should have it second, third, so on. How long committees should have it for. So a lot of times, there's one committee that is amped up, ready to go on a piece of legislation. they get it marked up. They have hearings on it. They get it marked up and reported out of the committee within a month. Then there's another committee not on board with the legislation and sits on it. So the speaker has the ability to give committees referrals for certain periods of time where there's a shot clock that's developed. And if the committee doesn't mark out in time, they've lost their chance to have a markup on the legislation. But with all of that, it's the leadership that is trying to guide that process, give the committees as much distance as possible to go about creating legislation, perfecting legislation. The issue experts really are there at the committees. You know, some of the unsung heroes in Congress are committee staff who are highly professionalized. They are issue experts. They are writing this legislation with a great deal of experience. Versus you go into a rank and file office, and this is not to knock on a rank and file office, but you're going to find a lot of young people there, folks fresh out of college like myself when I first got to the Hill. The committees have lots of institutional knowledge. So the leadership primarily is trying to get the committees to perfect legislation after it's been introduced. But they always have to have a mind towards moving a legislative agenda. That's what they're elected to do by their colleagues, and to make sure that it doesn't go on and on and on for too long a period of time.
So in media reporting, and I think in conversations among politically minded people, you hear a lot about the Intel Committee or Judiciary or APROPS or Ways and Means. But one committee you hear a lot less about is Rules. But despite that, it's one of the most powerful mechanisms in the House of Representatives. Can you talk a little bit about how the internal politics of the Rules Committee both sways and shapes legislation and the role of the Rules Committee relative to the majority leadership in the House?
Yeah. Well, the Rules Committee really is leadership personified on the House floor. The Rules Committee chairman is a member of leadership. He's appointed or she's appointed by the Speaker of the House. The DEC, in terms of the member ratio, majority to minority, is so skewed in favor of the majority that there's no way that the minority would ever be able to influence that process. It's really how you're tying up legislation at the committees have had their say, they've perfected, but it's now time to come in and the leadership to make the final decisions. There's still a dispute between the Homeland Security Committee and the Judiciary Committee over who had primacy over an issue or how Judiciary treated it versus how Homeland treated it. The Rules Committee is going to make that decision for them, and that's leadership making the decision. So again, they were elected, the House leadership was elected by their colleagues to move a legislative agenda, and they're the ones who are making the final decisions at the end of the day. The Rules Committee is actually effectuating those decisions. And then, back to the OCD of the House, is then providing a highly structured process on the House floor where things hopefully, although sometimes things do go wrong on the House floor, things are going to go according, unlike the Senate where it's a conversation, things have been predetermined in the House. This debate is going to take Tuesday through Thursday. It's going to finish by noon on Thursday. It's going to result in 218 votes passing this legislation, and these 10 amendments are going to have been debated. Three of them were okay passing, and those three are the ones that passed, and there you've got your legislative product at the end of the day. But that Rules Committee is the leadership imposing its will, hopefully to the approval of their members, but it's them imposing their will on the end of the process and making decisions.
So, Kyle, that sets up something that I thought was done really nicely in this book, and that is while you're writing about the House separately and you're writing about the Senate separately, this is really a book about contrasts and not just differences in the way districts are or differences between the number of members in the House versus the Senate, but internal procedure being a series of contrasts, how differently the Senate works compared to the House. So Rima, I want to jump over to you. Kyle talked a lot in his previous response and in the writing on the House and the book about really the power of leadership in the House, the power of the majority in the House, and that's the key. The Senate side, the Senate part of this book focuses on the power of the individual senator, whether it's a Democrat in a Republican-controlled Senate or a Republican in a Republican-controlled Senate. So can you talk a little bit about that individual power dynamic and reflect on one of the items that I thought was really eloquent in the book in talking about individual powers, individual abilities of senators to use rules to their advantage. You say that while some efforts may be politically feasible, they may not be, procedurally feasible, they may not be politically advisable. And I thought that was a really nice way to talk about a senator needing not just to maximize what he can do, which leadership might do on a daily basis in the House, but has to think in the long run about what that might mean individually for his or her caucus and for the institution as a whole.
Thank you. We keep having this overarching theme of there's the rules and the political context. And, I think I'll use a straw man example. So all 100 have the ability to say no at any point to what we're doing, right? So we're making deals every day. And in that deal making, we're building pressure. So you'll see sometimes, we'll do a big midnight tax deal or a midnight spending deal. It'll come over. And the question is, well, can we pass this quickly? And maybe some members are unhappy. And we tell them, if you get X amount of hours to debate and you have a chance to vote no, will you at least let us set up the timing so that the timing works out right? And they have a choice. They can keep all of their colleagues there waiting and drag it out for days and experience the consequences of that. Or they can show some cooperation and express their protest in other formats. Or if they are mad about a particular thing, they can articulate that to the proper committee chairman or, to their leadership and try and, get something future-wise for that. I mean, so it is this sort of this constant exchange. And in that calculation for them has to be, going forward, not just reputationally, but, are they serving the overall purpose they came for, right? We're all here with sort of a vision of how to try and solve problems for the nation, move it forward. And inputting into all of that are these everyday micro decisions. So an example is, when we lay down a bill on the floor, it's born with a little amendment tree, and there's some sample trees in the book. What does that bill represent? That bill represents, maybe years, months, hours of committee hard work. So you have a chairman and a ranking member that have brought this bill to the floor. If it's on the floor, it means that leadership has said it's okay to be on the floor. So already, say you're an unhappy senator, and you're like, I don't like this stuff happening on the floor. But if you know nothing else, you already know two things. Leadership likes it, and the chairman likes it. Okay. And now you arrive on the floor, and you say, well, I'm really unhappy, and I want to offer a poison pill amendment that I know will derail this bill and will make it, an anathema, and they can't get 60 votes if this thing is adopted. And that's, if you can gain access to the tree, you have the right, you may be able to offer that amendment. Maybe you're going to be able to jam up the process. But what will it mean if you do that? You will have derailed a bill that maybe if you are of the majority party that maybe your leadership wanted or that was important. Or maybe it was a bill that was important to a large coalition of members from both parties. You will upset a chairman. You might need have other business to transact before that committee in the future. There's a question of today, but then there's also the question of your entire experience in the Senate. And so often what happens is everyone is aware that everyone has those options. So it's the reservoir dog standoff. And from there we can have a conversation to say, okay, I know you can do that. I know you can derail this bill. How can we talk to you about not derailing it? These are your options. And you'll find sometimes with new arrivals, sometimes people will just, read the rule book and be very earnest, right? Pick up Riddick's and be like, well, I see on the tree there's this slot, and forget to factor in all of these other realities other than, so this is here, we can do it, let's go do it. And you'll often see then there's an educational process that occurs afterwards. And if you're into like C-SPAN archives, there are some great moments in quick quorum call history where someone has been able to take the floor, offer an amendment that was a surprise to the managers, and you'll see the Senate go into quorum call and kind of everyone scatter as there's an attempt to figure out, you know, to then have that conversation. When the political reality is you can have that conversation without necessarily making the maneuver. So, you know, run everything through the double process, right? Sure. Always know your procedural options for any, you know, in general, even for a watcher, and then figure out, okay, but then what's feasible? What is the best way to actually get to your endpoint? It might not be through the super aggressive move.
So I'm going to ask just a couple of more questions before I turn it over to all of you, and these will be for all of our authors. The first is about one of the more fascinating times in Congress, at least fascinating for me. I assume it's hair pulling out for you guys, and that is when a new Congress begins. So a new Congress will begin, and there are two types of new Congresses, right? There's an off-year new Congress, and there's a presidential year new Congress. And so during that time, especially the new Congress we just had sworn in with a new president, you have a lot of freshmen who don't know what they're getting into. You have also a lot of legislation or nominations or items that need to be advanced very quickly or at least as efficiently as is possible. So can you both talk a little bit about the challenges and the frustrations that exist in the early days of a new Congress and how leadership in both chambers deals with this balance between tremendous demand and lower than normal capacity because you do have so many new members? And also, do you want this to be required reading for any freshman class? That's the last part of that question.
Well, I'll start. Two experiences, beginning of Congresses come to mind. The last two administrations we've had, the start of their administration, has come for both of them with unified government. So both at the beginning of the Obama administration, now at the beginning of the Trump administration, they've had unified majority control of Congress. That's a big deal because it creates, in that first 100 days or so that's used quite a bit, it creates this huge opportunity for them to get legislation done. Now, one of those administrations did it pretty effectively. The other one is still working their way through it. You have the benefit of the doubt with the freshmen, as John was talking about, who are new, neophytes. They don't know the process. Often that can act as a hindrance. When you have unified government like that, you've got so much momentum behind you. You've got wind at your sails. So even though this administration has faltered, what did you see in January? You saw the Congress come together and pass an FY17 budget to set up this process for reconciliation for healthcare. But that's something you wouldn't have been able to see Republicans do but for the fact you had this new administration. Take a different example, a midterm election, and I'm thinking about the 2010 election where you've just had 2 years of unified control for the Democrats, and now the House is flipped, and it's flipped in dramatic fashion. You have 79 House Republican freshmen in that class. That's over one-third of the Republican conference for that coming Congress. And just in the House as a whole, when you added the Democrats in there, it was significant. I can't remember the ratio, but it was significant. So you had a large changeover in the makeup of the Congress on the House side. And that acted as a deterrent for legislation. So immediately that Congress was bogged down in government funding. We had fights over government funding in February, March, April, finally passing a deal for the previous year's appropriation. And then that bled right in to the debt limit negotiations and the standoff that went into nearly August of that year that then begot the super committee and sequestration, which we're living under now. So it all depends on what the makeup is of the Congress and who, if the party syncs with the incoming administration. If it does, you have lots of momentum, and the lack of experience for the new members is less of an issue. If you don't, then the lack of experience for the new members is hugely challenging.
So I think the start of our Congress is really exciting. I mean, it's new. Everything's new. But the advantage also in the Senate is only a third of the Senate is up every 2 years. So the upheaval for us is a little bit different. And even the shift of parties for us is a little less dramatic, you know, like in these really detailed ways, like our budgets shift less dramatically, the staff shift less dramatically. In the House, it's much more British.
People get kicked out of their offices.
Yeah, oh, it's terrible.
Total upheaval.
Terrible. Where it's, you know, it's the Senate, it's a slower process. But I also think, you know, it's an interesting time to ask this question because we are more broadly, we are all of us living through a generational shift in the legislative branch, which is that if you look at the Senate, and I think the House, just 10 years ago, it looks dramatically different than it does now, where you just had this sort of wave of like the post-Watergate babies and the Reagan babies. You know, you have these waves of sort of historic, epic members that have been here for huge deals starting to cycle out. And the new folks coming in, and these new folks come from a very different world, the world of the internet and the cell phone and Post Citizens United and all kinds of new things, you know, have on both sides, you know, the crucible that is creating these new classes is a little bit different than what created a member in 1982, for example. And, you know, I think in the Senate, it was either in 10 or 12, even just for our one-third, if you looked at the Republican caucus, it was maybe almost two-thirds were still in their first term, somewhere in their 6 years in their first term, which is wild. And if you look at the committee slates now on the Republican side and you see who's up for chairmanship, it's, you know, it used to be, you know, sort of like a Senator Lugar, someone that had 30 years of relationships was ascending to a chairmanship, and it's the benches are much younger now. So we're definitely in a time of transition. And retraining. When it comes to just the 2 year at the start of a Congress, I mean, they're always interesting that everyone's reconfiguring, right? So it's new personalities. It often means you have new ranking members, new chairmen, different places. And, you know, these are all spokes that end up influencing how conversations go throughout a Congress. And, you know, I think for us, it's getting the first few months are waiting to see what the majority agenda is going to be, whichever the majority party is, and then getting people settled into kind of how are they going to address that. But beyond that, there's a lot of just basic training, like where's your office, who's going to be your APROPE staffer, you know, who's who, making some of these mistakes and foibles, learning from your mistakes, you know, in the full legislative process. And I think being part of that, of this kind of larger shift. So it varies by member. And again, I think the Senate experience is different because they're individualized. But the broader shift is what has made the bigger difference for us, not the individualized every 2 year shift.
And a broader note and a procedural note is all new members do actually go through a formal training. So they sit for, I think it's a week or two, with tons of experts. They meet with leadership, they meet with their new colleagues. And so they get a sense, you know, very quickly of how complicated their institution is and what's expected of them. To go to different committee meetings, to meet with their constituents, to answer, you know, calls and emails and messages, and meet with their colleagues, and what a hotline is, and how to, you know, what the behavior on the floor is from you. So there is a procedural education for them as well.
And liftoff is kinder for our guys. You know, you can take the first 2 years and really learn, and then go from there. It's not you're not immediately thrown into your reelection, which I imagine is brutal.
Right. And they also, you have the election in early November, and then that process for the new Congress really starts in mid-November and carries through in December. The Congress doesn't officially start until January 3rd, but there's already been a month and a half of prep work for that new Congress. And then it takes another 2 months just to get everything fully transitioned, committees reconstituted, rules passed, et cetera. So it's really... March 1st is when, even though a Congress officially begins January 3rd, it's March 1st where you feel like the Congress is now up and running.
All right, we have about a half hour left. I could ask Trevor, Rima, and Kyle questions all day, but that would be boring for you guys. So when I call on you, please wait for a microphone. There's a gentleman right in the back with his hand raised. Yeah, just wait for a microphone. Please ask a brief question and do not filibuster, because I will cut you off.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub. I'm retired from the State Department Foreign Service, so I have some familiarity with State Department, other agencies, and national security. I'd like to ask you about the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security, the conventional wisdom seems to be that this is a horrible aggregation of agencies that cover immigration, airline security, and who knows how many other things. I wonder if you could discuss the procedures and processes that led to the creation of this department, and if you feel that this was adequate or if it was hurried, perhaps under a pressure in order to do something in response to 9/11.
Well, on the House side, the complicating factor was propping up the authorizing committee to oversee the department. And Rima's hometown congressman, Chris Cox, was at the forefront of that. You can imagine that standing committees in the House, it took members longer to become chairman at that time, but you've gone 20, 30 years to finally take over this grand committee, whether it's Transportation and Infrastructure Committee or the Judiciary Committee, and they've had a storied history and storied jurisdiction. And now this guy, Chris Cox, I wouldn't say is using 9/11, but because of 9/11, there's this urgency to create this new department that has new powers, and now you're propping up a standing committee to oversee it and to authorize it, and you've got all these folks on the Hill who are pushing back on that. So on the House side, and this was towards the beginning of my congressional career, it was pretty ugly, the behind closed door, the knockdown, drag out fights between the committee chairman and Chris Cox specifically, because he was becoming the new chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, over these jurisdictional questions that you're raising that are highly complicated. You've got lots of different entities rolled into one.
I'll say in the Senate, there was a similar experience in that it involved the restructuring of GAC, currently known as HSGAC, Homeland Security and Government Affairs. And I mean, I think born from the sort of study of how to re-centralize some communication in government to prevent further tragedy. I have not done a deep dive into that moment in time in Congress, so I'm happy to converse with you after or to put you in touch with folks who are heavily involved in the oversight process of DHS if you want to talk to them more. But I would not be able to go beyond what Kyle said.
I was not personally involved.
This young lady right here.
Diane Silber, I'm a clinical psychologist. For both of you, but primarily the Congress, I understand that fundraising is one of the biggest things, and they're asked to do 4 hours a day of fundraising outside of the building. Can you comment on that and tell us a little more about that?
Well, it's a challenge in managing, again, the schedule of the House, which is highly scheduled, highly structured. We never factored it into how we were coming up with the week schedule for the House or the monthly schedule. It was just known that members, I guess in some ways, we always protected lunches and dinners. So I'll correct myself here. I'll revise and extend. There's a reason you're protecting lunches and dinners. And why is that? When members are in town, what are they primarily doing for their lunches and their dinners? They're holding fundraisers, right? And that's been set up long in advance. They're going to some restaurant on Capitol Hill to meet with folks who are going to write them a check and talk about legislation. So almost every lunch and dinner is accounted for. We do build that into the schedule. Otherwise, how they go about fundraising, doing phone calls across the street, that's done on their own time. They have to figure out a way to fit it into their schedule. I think that does get to Rima's point about how busy these folks are. You know, often, take whether you believe in money and politics out of it for a second, but I think members of Congress, we view them as having pretty light schedules, as going on vacation in August and going on recess and that sort of thing. They are very, very busy, and it starts early in the morning, it goes late at night, and it goes beyond them being in D.C. too. Yes, fundraising is a part of that, and it's a growing part of that. It's not the only part of it. So I think there's a nod to it in the schedule, but it's not explicit.
I think, I mean, there could be like a 5-day forum on fundraising and politics. I'd be curious after discussing with you kind of from which node you are particularly approaching it. It's correct that there's a, you know, if you're planning for member schedules, there's no realistic way to plan for a member without putting in fundraising time. And that's divided between meals, other convenings, and what's called call time. It's all under very structured rules. And on our side, it all has to happen outside of the buildings and sort of separate. And there's firewalls so that there's sort of a disassociation between what's happening amongst like the policy staff and then who members are seeing in the outside world. And this very interesting legal structure. I'll just say this, something worthy of greater study. It is impacting, I think of a good way to say it, for the Shakespeare readers. I think in Henry V, there's a line about the theater is the Aegean court. It's representing the battlefield raging outside the theater as represented on the stage. And I think if you, I think a way, there are multiple inputs for all these members, right? And I think fundraising is just one of the things they have to factor in as they are building out their careers and figuring out just how to explain themselves, right? If you take a vote, you have to go home and explain, like, what did I do? And all of that takes money. And part of the ways that these battles are, the battles that we're taking on these two floors, the way that they're waging outside, the fundraising was one more of those spokes. And it's one of the ways that they get inputs. It's one of the ways that they hear from different constituencies as well. But then there's also this whole other side of it. And so it's definitely worthy of consideration. But I would just consider it in the great spoke and the great dialogue that's raging outside of the walls of the Capitol, that it has its kind of place in that canon.
So one slight irony to fundraising is those who need to raise more money are those who are generally the more moderate members because they're coming from competitive districts. So it's a district that breaks kind of 50-50 between Republican and Democrat. Those who are more on the ideological far ends of the spectrum do not have to do a whole lot of fundraising.
Well, once.
Yeah.
All the way in the back in the center.
Thank you for your time today, Kate Howard. I've got a question on interactions. I wonder if you could please speak to the interactions between the Senate and the House at the committee level and the leadership level, and also given the seismic changeover of the leadership, just the membership in general of both bodies, when do out of ordinary processes simply become what's expected in the norm, i.e. a continuing resolution?
Appropriations.
Sorry?
Sure. First, I want to say, as people are sort of trickling, thank you for spending your morning with us talking about Congress before noon. It's a lot. and especially to my friends, thank you. Meant a lot. A couple of things. So one on the CRs and kind of normal, abnormal. It's gonna sound super like DC insider to say it this way, but I think it's difficult to peg things as normal. If you see an election year coming, you tend to know that, okay, it'll be really choppy political waters, so they'll have to do a CR to get themselves past the election day, and then they can come back and sort out what an omnibus or the full process will look like. Or, until maybe 06-ish, there was a process where we could do all 12 appropriations bills. We fund the government through 12 appropriations bills, where you could do them more individually and then get them moving. But there are definitely years where that was not the case. And I think in some ways the debate that would have happened and those 12 individual bills on the floor has just shifted to different locations. What happens in committee now is a lot more important in the committee markup, providing the base text for what will end up being in an omnibus. Or, we can have another day seminar on earmarks if anyone's interested, but, you talk about riders as kind of a new earmark. I mean, there's all the pressures that have always existed and the way these bills are created are similar. They have just shifted to different parts of the process. And I think it's an open question as to how much you can peel back or how much is just going to be part of what we call the new modern American politics. And it'll look different probably in 10 years from now. I mean, these are living, breathing institutions, you know, that change. And so I think in some sense, I mean, the CR example is probably one of the best examples in sort of extended use. You know, I try to be wary of looking back with too much sort of haziness, I guess, in terms of, you know, it was, and that there's always been some difficulty. It's just that it was maybe different spokes of the process where you saw those pressures. And now we're just seeing them at the very last step, where it used to be there was a little more control. And then as for the relationships, I think we have very different answers. In the Senate, you know, we are, I think the way the Senate is structured, we keep going back to the 100 and the power of the 100. You know, power comes from the caucuses up. And, you know, at a certain point, yes, the two leaderships have to make decisions for how's the week going to look, what's going to happen, and start to enforce those strategies. But it all comes from upward conversation. And partly because these members are all over, they're in their states, they're hearing all their other inputs, and that's all flowing back in. And so it is the contact is constant. And it's constant across all spokes. So there's constant contact between the rank and file members and their staffs and the leadership staffs. When issues are ripe, then you'll have an uptake of conversations between rank and file staffs and committee staffs. There is at least weekly, if not more, contact between leadership and committee staffs. And if the committee is on the floor, there's a 24/7 contact level. There's frequent contact across leaderships between the two parties just to figure out what's going to happen. And so there is, it is the sort of a constant interface. You cannot take the people out of the process. And just because there's no other way to figure out how everything's going to go.
I do think there's a surprisingly lack of communication, though, but across the two chambers. So that you do have constant communication between rank and file and committees and leadership and committees inside of each chamber. The back and forth between the two is very light, and it's done pretty much at the top level. The Speaker's office on the House side is really the only one designated on the House side to deal with the Senate in constant communication. They're also the only one deputized to deal with the White House. I think it probably surprised you how little there's still communication between the committees on each side, especially the appropriators. They're always in the know. Everyone else is on the outside. But at the leadership levels, it's pretty light. And at the rank and file level, unless they're in your state delegation, so unless you're talking to your home state senator, there's not a lot of interaction there. It's again, one of those big differences in how these are two very separate entities.
And usually a question of what will the other one bear?
Right. You're taking a guess. The yeah. House will send over a budget maybe next week to the Senate. And I was just talking to a House staffer. I said, well, what happens when the Senate sends you back a skinny budget? And he's like, I don't know what the Senate's going to send us back.
And we don't know yet either.
This gentleman's been standing the whole time, so he's earned it. And then Molly as well after him.
Thank you very much. Citizens are always curious to know more about the governing institutions, especially to keep them open and transparent and also accountable. And the Freedom of Information Act is a tool in the hands of the citizens to keep these institutions very open and transparent. But in some countries, this act doesn't apply to legislative bodies. I'm from Canada. So I work in that area. It's called Access to Information Act. I work at the Prime Minister's office. So my question to you is to know how the Freedom of Information Act can help citizens to keep the legislative bodies like the Congress, the Senate, more open, more accountable, more transparent. Thank you.
I would actually say I'm not sure it needs to go to the Freedom of Information Act necessarily. Congress is a pretty open body. You can walk into the offices, talk to the staff, talk to congresspeople. It's actually a quite public forum, and obviously there's strength in numbers when you come with a coalition, whether that's a coalition of your, you know, peers in the neighborhood you live with, which are voters, or if it's a coalition of, you know, industry. You can usually get a congressperson to at least listen to you. They may not agree, and they may have a bigger constituency on the other side of an issue, but generally they'll listen as long as you're being honest and fair about your opinion. So.
Yeah, I think it's less needed in the Congress. It's used more often in the administration, and then the Congress will take that information and it will inform their oversight responsibilities. When you see it pop up on the congressional side is often when you're in the heat of legislating and things are going on behind closed doors and the public doesn't have access to that. Yeah, I think that's just a natural process throughout life, that negotiations have to be done in small venues and away from the limelight in order to get a deal made. But there has been a lot more debate about that recently.
So if you buy one book today, make sure it's inside Congress. If you buy a second book, it's from our colleague in the back, Molly Reynolds, who just published a great book specifically on the reconciliation process. So let's get a question from her.
Thank you, John. My name is Molly Reynolds. I work here at Brookings. And my question for you guys is, so I think most Congress watchers would say that we're living in an era of centralized leadership control, particularly in the House, where it's structural, but even in the Senate. And so if you were trying to convince a new congressional staffer that they should really invest time in understanding the procedures, why, in a world where so much gets decided centrally and just sort of flows from there, why is it worth the time of a rank-and-file staffer to really master the kind of stuff that you guys write so well about in your book?
Well, I'll give you one example just on the House side, almost as a pushback to that motion to vacate the chair. Does anyone know what that is? That's the reason that John Boehner is no longer Speaker of the House, is because there is a group of members, they've named themselves the House Freedom Caucus, who threatened to use a procedural motion against him to force another vote on the speakership. So you vote on the speaker at the beginning of each Congress. Unlike the other leadership positions in the House, which are voted on internally by the conferences and the caucuses and just need majority vote in those separate entities, the speaker has to face a vote on the House floor and be elected by the entire House, which means he or she needs to get to 218 votes on the House floor to become speaker. And after about a year or so of John Boehner's most recent run as Speaker, this rabble-rousing body inside the House decided that they were going to threaten to reopen that vote again, basically. And so, yes, leadership is very centralized. I think it's very important to understand leadership. That is often where decisions are made. But we are at this new point, this new normal that Rima was talking about and that was asked about earlier, where I think it's almost a post-2010 world where these caucuses can band together and be quite powerful by manipulating the process of the House in particular and using the rules to their advantage to kind of run circles around leadership and make leadership's life really difficult.
I'd say, congrats on writing about reconciliation, very timely. For a couple reasons. I mean, one is just that if you're going to do something, you should do it well. You know, I think being a staffer, being paid by the taxpayer is like a holy thing. People work until like May, I think, to pay their taxes. So, to show up and try and be the best staffer you can be. I think, two, is just to be as empowered as possible. And this goes to staffers and beyond. There is this issue of leadership or not, especially in the Senate in particular, an empowered member, a member that is always very aware of their rights, like very aware of where they are in the Reservoir Dogs scenario, will typically make out better than someone who's not aware of their rights.
Right.
And so if your staffer shows up to like the big meeting or the conference or whatever, and they don't even know their own powers, then they're gonna get sort of a shorter end of a bargain than they possibly could have. So that's a starting point. The second is, you know, if you don't understand the flow of the chamber, then it's much harder to identify, you know, at what point you need to be pushing and pulling and on which levers. And, you know, if you don't understand the dynamic about the hotlines or, you know, sort of the best way to get certain things done, you know, so say your staff, you're dealing with a question and you're trying to strategize, how are we going to answer this? Is the best way a letter? Do we need a hearing? Do we want an amendment? Can we ride with a big package? Is this a 10-year plan or can we do this in 2 weeks? You know, what is the legislative calendar? Is there something that will apply to this moving in the next 6 months? Like there, you know, if you haven't, you know, the leadership may be making kind of the large scale decisions for how that stuff's going to ultimately move through. But, you know, all the inputs on the way there, you know, can typically be seen much earlier. And if someone is aware of those pressures and understands where to plug in, It is amazing the difference it can make for their member in terms of their member's accomplishments. Or if their member seeks to just be someone that slows things down, it's also very important as well. And in the Senate, regard, you know, 100, and yes, there's the two leaderships, any one of them, you know, fully equipped with a procedure book, can really cause some shifts and changes in the direction of things. And I think, like Kyle said, there is a new normal. You know, we keep saying it, but I think just because it cannot be overemphasized, you know, it comes up, you know, if you can't hold your votes, if you can't hold your coalition in either place, then you have to change your plan. And so I think, in that sense, having an awareness too, of, okay, so you changed the plan, where are you going? And you need to know the rules. I mean, you need to understand the structure to be able to have good answers to those questions, to be a relevant staffer.
I would add two quick things to that. First is to sort of expand on what you both said, is for your member, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, right? You're just getting rolled over. And from a professional point of view, a rank and file staffer is probably hoping to one day be a leadership staffer. And it's going to give you a huge advantage to understand what you're getting into, A, to decide whether you want to do it, but B, to be a part of those conversations for the leadership staff, and for the leadership staff to know that there are other informed, empowered staffers on their side is a big deal.
All right, we have about 3 minutes left, so let's take two rapid-fire questions. This gentleman up here, this young lady right here.
Thank you very much, Larry Checo. I've got a million questions for you, but I'm going to stick with just one. Something like the Hastert rule, okay? Is it a real rule, or is it something that he just made up? He just made it up, okay.
He didn't make it up, but there were other people who coined the term.
Who coined the term. So what does that do to the dynamic of legislation? In other words, prior to him not making it up but enforcing it, right, did people bring bills to the floor prior to knowing whether they could pass or not? Or is that something that has become institutionalized now?
Well, getting to pass it, and the Hastert rule, for those who don't know, is to get a majority of the majority. Before you bring something to the floor, if you're the Republican conference and you have 240 members, you need to get 50 plus 1% of your members to approve of that legislation before bringing it to the floor. It was more of sort of a guiding principle than it ever was a hard and fast rule. It's come into play a lot since, again, 2010, this new class that came in at the end of that year, where just the ordinary business has been put into question, things like raising the debt limit. So the Gephardt rule, which was actually a rule in House rules where if you passed a budget resolution, the debt limit would be raised automatically. That was taken out of the rule book. And so now you had to pass a debt limit, and you had a Republican-controlled House, but a Democrat-controlled Senate, and a Democrat in the White House, and spending was a big deal. And so now, all of a sudden, the debt limit is a big deal and continues to be a big deal, but it is impossible to get a majority of House Republicans to ever vote for a debt limit increase. So you're having to violate that principle much more frequently now, because the regular business that prevents things from going boom, like a debt limit breach or a government shutdown, require these new types of coalitions where Democrats have a seat at the table in the House when the minority party traditionally has not had a seat at the table. So the Hastert rule, yes, is still alive and well. It's still alive, but just not, it's on life support.
All right, last question quickly.
Hi, my name is Lauren. I'm a student at American University, and thank you for taking my question. I have a more general question about someone that's either a young professional or a student looking to help solve, you know, the nation's most pressing problems. We often get images of corruption and inefficiency in the Congress. So I was wondering if you all could shed some light on, I guess, the most effective and efficient way to enter into the world of public policy and, you know, actually make effective change.
Great question.
Go ahead.
Both of
you. I mean, my very simple, obvious answer is, you know, spend time either interning or trying to get a job on the Hill or an organization that advocates for an issue you care about. If you want to do research, look at institutions like the Brookings Institution, who are going to allow you to spend a lot of time, you know, taking a deep dive into those issues. But if you're looking at the Hill in particular, you know, it's really about most likely where you're from, and those ties to the district or the member, and how you can contribute for them.
I'll just say thank you for the question. I think it depends on the individual and where you want to be. I mean, there's a sense that people have to be in Washington to try and address some of this when, you know, I think we're like the goalie at the end of the game, right? There's all this amazing stuff happening in the states, governors and mayors and sheriffs and, you know, it's what's happening around the country is extraordinary. And so I think people have to decide, do you want to be here or do you want to be somewhere else? And what do you want to focus on? And go from there. And outside of government, and be an amazing advocate, be an amazing, you know, whatever spoke you want to come into, be amazing at it. And for here, I think it's just the same things that apply almost everywhere else. Show some good judgment, show some good teamwork ability, and be a good writer if you can, and in a very general sense, you know, and show some initiative. I mean, it's amazing. American politics is so open. Volunteer on a campaign, show, you know, take an internship. I mean, we are actually on the Hill now, we're having these conversations about paying interns so we can hopefully expand the scope of who can be an intern as well. Just on a practical level, who can come and afford to live in Washington. You know, but it's, I think if it's something someone's interested in and they're willing to put in the time, then it's open to everyone. And in terms of the inefficiency or the corruption, you know, where it's no more or less inefficient or corrupt than all other human endeavors, I think. And I will say the people, the extraordinary staff that crafted the Affordable Care Act, many of them began their work in the early 90s and waited 20 years for historic mathematical compilation in 2009 to be able to have a lot of these ideas come to fruition. And, you know, it's federal level work is supposed to be a slower burn, but a really extraordinary burn. I mean, in a good way, the good burn, and that it changes, you know, it changes lives, it changes the country. And, you know, I think this goes into that other decision. If you want to see some more immediate action, then the city level is an amazing place to start, and you get to see things a lot faster. The federal level, you might have an idea, and you know, keep working on it, build, and you might 10 years it might move forward. You know, the stimulus had very few new things in it. The stimulus was actually a package of ideas that people had been studying, and you know, cheering on, and like their moment had come to ride. And so it's, if you have that patience and you're willing to kind of deal with some of the sort of unsexy bureaucracy of it, then here. But the spokes are all open.
I will always be an advocate of the Hill. I think it's a great place to work. or at a young age, you can be exposed to so many issues and have an impact on those issues. As a 24-year-old, you can work on writing legislation. It's not uncommon to walk into a congressional office, especially on the House side, less so on the Senate side, but especially on the House side, and find a 25-year-old chief of staff for a member of Congress. And it really is a meritocracy. You move up quite quickly on the Hill. There's tons of changeover. The House side, you know, you have these members coming in and out every 2 years, and staff's turning over, and I just think it's a very exciting place to work. I've never had a more rewarding job than the jobs that I had on the Hill. It's some of the most exciting professional times of my life, and I highly recommend it to anyone who wants to be involved in politics, but just civics, learning civics in this country. I don't think there's a better way to do it than to go experience it, and whether that's at the local level or it's at the federal level, if you choose to do it at the federal level, I think the Hill is a fantastic place to start.
Seconded.
So I encourage all of you to go outside and buy a copy of Inside Congress. I'd like to thank the Brookings Executive Education Program and Brookings Institution Press, as well as our authors today.